Hello, this is Down the Back of the Seats. I'm Ellen, cinema manager at Campbelltown Picture House.
And I'm Alistair, a film and theatre maker based on the Isle of Mull.
And Alistair, what is this podcast about?
This podcast explores what happens when public spaces and the public meet. What's left behind? What's been found that's unexpected? What stories are there to tell? So it's tales from behind the scenes at the cinema, theatre, concert hall, wherever people meet, leave.
It's going jolly well. Is it because we've got an actor this week and are you intimidated by the actor's presence?
No, God, no, not at all. You can tell he's very fine already. So it's tales from behind the scenes at the cinema, theatre, concert hall, wherever people meet, linger and leave things or bits.
Lovely. That was great.
I don't want to, I'm going to try and say just bits normally.
This week we are going a little bit off-piste again. We've got the wonderful actor...
At this time in the morning.
We're welcoming the wonderful Emilio Vieira. Emilio is an actor at Stratford Festival in Ontario. I know Emilio, sort of, because during lockdown, the first lockdown, I was going into the cinema once a week to check that the projectors worked, and I would turn everything on and just run something through the projector, the projectors to make sure that they were working. Emilio's theatre company and film company made a short film during lockdown as a little project called A Love Story. And one week I decided that that would be the thing that I would run through the projector. So I sent Emilio a picture and Ellen, the person that he was working with, I sent them a picture of their film up on the big screen in Screen One with all the beautiful curtains and all the surround. And they were very sweetly, very touched by it. And so we sort of had a short correspondence, and then obviously then nothing happened for years because lockdowns and COVID.
Pandemia.
And eventually I managed to get back to Stratford this year and messaged Emilio again and said, will you be on our podcast? And very graciously, he said yes. We weren't able to get anything done in Stratford while I was there, unfortunately. We weren't quite able to make the timings work, but he joined us on Zoom a couple of days ago, and this is what we're going to listen to now. I am absolutely beside myself to be on Zoom with Emilio Vieira. Hello.
Hello.
Emilio, you're currently in the midst of a season at Stratford Festival in Ontario, which I've just got back from. You're in Grand Magic, which is brilliant, which I saw, and the production that everybody is talking about, which is Richard II, which I'm absolutely gutted that I didn't see, but I'm hoping to come back. And this is, how many seasons at Stratford have you done now?
This is my sixth season.
Wow. Including appearances in my two absolute favorites, which was Napoli Millenaria and Coriolanus, which was both of those things absolutely blew my mind. But in previous episodes, we've talked a lot about audience behavior and just sort of people being massive coins in theaters and cinemas, and how much that baffles and fascinates us. What is your relationship with audiences? Are they friend or foe?
In my experience, especially given the great privilege to rehearse as long as we do at the Stratford Festival, often rehearsing two plays at the same time. And then if you're on a third show, you sort of open one, tech the other, then open the second while rehearsing the third. And so you're in constant motion working on three shows. And the audience's role in that is the last character to arrive. So we do all of our work thinking, hey, this is going to be great. And then they show up and they sniff out all the crap right away. And they know exactly what they want. And there's a great balance to be made between surfing their reaction, which I think is the right thing to do, and the wrong thing to do would be to allow them to drive the ship, because at the end of the day, we want them to be with us, not ahead us, and certainly not holding the reins. That becomes particularly tough in a comedy, but I've been fortunate, I think, to do a great mix of Shakespeare's that everyone, you know, sort of loves and knows, and then very odd shows like Napoli Millionaria is a play that no one in at least the North American sphere had ever heard of. And much the same with Grand Magic, written by the same author, Eduardo Di Filippo. You're getting audiences leaning forward at every moment, completely unaware of what's to come next. And that may be the goal we try to go for with every show that we have. But of course, people have seen, you know, The Tempest a million times or King Lear a million times. It becomes a lot harder to surprise them. And in surfing their reactions, I really do welcome the audience when they come, especially when we've been in a rehearsal hall for 2 months by ourselves. But yeah, of course, as this podcast, I'm sure, has illuminated time and time again, they can be really rough.
Napoli Millionaria, that is, and also to a certain extent, Grand Magic. I think my reaction to those two plays was completely at odds with everybody else. Because it's sort of, I mean, they're both ostensibly kind of broad comedies, but I was traumatized by what, like, particularly Napoli, which is what I'm going to call it now. It's so sad, and it was so heartbreaking, and everybody around me was laughing their heads off, which, I mean, it was funny, don't get me wrong, and especially in Grand Magic, you've got one of the best roles in it, because you come in 20 minutes, get all the laughs, and then you leave. It's brilliant.
It's thoroughly Italian in that the play doesn't stick to one genre and has the size of an opera within it.
Right.
I sort of found it akin to when I saw a beautiful Korean film, Parasite, for the first time. I was sitting in the cinema completely just gobsmacked, not knowing what to expect next. And there's immense tragedy within the story, and yet we're laughing, and we're even laughing at people's misfortune, and then kind of walk away from it going, was I right to do that? I think Eduardo does the same. And what I learned was that there's a different cultural sensibility that North Americans maybe have less exposure to, being so filtered through the American television lens, that we have a kind of Hollywood expectation of how certain stories will go, and then it's completely upended because there's a whole other cultural, you know, cornerstone that these stories are being told from. As you say, in Grand Magic, I'm very fortunate to play one of the comedic parts, and I recognize that my function in it is, I think this is a Lorca quote, but I come back to it time and time again, to open their throats with laughter before shoving the truth down in. And as you know, Ellen, having seen the show, after my scene and Steven's scene as Roberto Maliano, which is also quite funny, but very dark as well, there's a gun on stage, threat of life. There is a truly tragic moment that the magician cannot change or get himself out of, and I once we discovered that our function was get the audience loose and ribs not so tight, so that they can be really gut punched by the twist in that story, that if you've been listening, you can kind of expect is going to happen, but you're not really expecting it to happen right then, and it does completely change the tenor of the show moving forward, which is, I mean, just brilliant. I don't know how many plays can successfully be, you know, situated in so many different genres and yet tell one huge story.
Mm-hmm. It's extraordinary. Do you, not in this particular show, but do you ever get cross with audiences for not having the reaction that you want them to? Come on, guys.
I was part of I've been part of two Molières. Both were modern adaptations. One was Tartuffe in 2017, which we later took to Toronto.
Which I missed as well, which I'm gutted. Tom Rooney, I love Tom Rooney so much. And
he's my hero, my favorite actor in the country. And then the other one last year was The Miser, which was quite a lot of fun. But I think what's most important in that show is pacing. And so when an audience doesn't go when you want them to go, you kind of get like, oh, are they gonna? And then again, surf them. You know, they might crest a little bit, and then you've got to keep going. And I always found the audiences I'm most pissed off with are the really helpful ones. That might be an invited dress rehearsal with your colleagues or the staff who are giving you a bunch of laughs because they think that's what you want. And that is the worst thing.
It's the worst laugh. Yeah.
I want to know what it's going to be. I don't want to know what you think I deserve out of it. You know, like if something's not going to land, don't let me feel like it's landing, because then I'm going to go into the first paying audience who doesn't give a crap. And they're going to be sitting there going, wow, I paid $60 to sit in the whatever third row, and this isn't funny.
That's how in actor training establishments, and you see that knowing laugh of, oh, you're so funny, oh, you are, that's very, and it just kind of breeds an arrogance in some performers that really, when they go on stage, they carry themselves in a way that's not healthy at all, and they expect that same laughter, and even though it's not there, they're still carrying themselves with that sense of, là je suis, you know, it's like, yeah. Oh, God, I hate it.
Yeah, totally, and it's just... I mean, I think it's part of the process to weather whatever kinds of people are going to be there, but there is a certain mob mentality that takes over when there's a loud laugher or someone who's trying to applaud after every scene. And don't get me wrong. I mean, we love it when it's right, but there always is that little taste of, is this real? Yeah. It's actually useful to us. I don't know that it is.
There's quite often, audience. There's a,
There's a
loud laugher in Shakespeare's quite often where they want to show everybody that they understand the wordplay or something, and you'll get a loud,
they've read the notes in the Arden Shakespeare. Yeah.
I have one story from, I've done Shakespeare in Hyde Park in Toronto twice now. And both times, the sort of conceit for that festival is a 90-minute edit of a comedy and a drama. I think it's actually changed now, and they do something different. But in the years that I did it, it was rep, and we would do one comedy, one tragedy, and they were 90-minute edits, no interval. Everybody gets off the hill before the mosquitoes eat you alive. And because of the edits, there'd be folks sitting with their Ardens, with their scripts, And knowing that a big cut was coming, I would pause to hear flip, 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 flip.
Oh my God.
Almost in unison as people tried to figure out where we had gone to. And I resisted the urge night after night to go, it'll be page 45 in the tele if you'd like to join us. Everything.
My co-host Alistair here has recently told a story about being very naughty indeed on stage, and he claims that it was nothing to do with him, but without
subject
making
subject of an anal violation on stage.
Oh Lord.
It was pretty traumatic. without making yourself unemployable, do you have any stories of being very naughty on stage, or other people trying to derail you?
Oh my gosh. I was named one of my university's disruptors. This was actually a thing that they did in the 50th anniversary of the theater program at York University. They named a disruptor for every year. And I was named the graduating class 2014 disruptor, and I certainly deserved it. In theater school, I mean, isn't everyone so naughty in theater school? But I remember there was a moment where I had to bow to a superior, and he returned my bow, and then we exited. It was in 'Tis Pity She's a Whore. And so I was playing like the incest brother lover thing, and he was the actual lover, and we like meet in the hallway outside of the woman's bedroom. And night after night, that bow got slower and a little bit more eye contact and waiting to go. And then knowing that my compatriot was the kind of actor who liked people to try to get him to corpse, and then sort of merited himself as being a good actor by whether or not he would corpse and if he could survive. We did one of those, you know, you're going the same way, trying to pass in the hallway. And I do think the director got very mad at us one night when it went on for a good minute. And it's not a terribly funny part of the play, so the audience didn't really go for it either. It was just for us. And I think, isn't that the worst, when you just make a bit that's just for you and your pal? But I do have another story from Shakespeare in Hyde Park. We used to challenge an actor to slide a word in to their text that was not part of the script. Ooh. And we were doing Measure for Measure, and I challenged the actor who was playing Claudio to use the word knives. And he has that famous speech in the cell, "I but to die and go we know not where." And he said, "Knives but to die and go we go not know not where." And nobody, of course, nobody knew that it had been slid in there, and the rest of us were just dying backstage. I was particularly naughty that summer because I think I was supposed to hand a bag to a character, and I actually went into his dressing room and grabbed his actual bag rather than the prop and handed it to him on stage. And he went red and had to stop himself from laughing. I got a very stern talking to from stage that personal items were not to join us on the stage.
Could you argue that these sort of things keep the performance fresh? Is that, would that be your, if you,
yeah,
or is it just?
I think there is certainly an argument there, and it is always about time and place, of course. I mean, the Hyde Park gig is, you're outside, essentially surrounded by an off-leash dog area, and so there's howling and children screaming and people's phones going off, or you can hear a car alarm in the parking lot, and so I think part of the job is being able to not ignore that there is an outside world that is right there, bursting its way onto the stage. We were doing Titus Andronicus there one year, and I had a speech about letting slip the dogs of war, and one of the dogs got loose from the park and joined me on stage. Had to kind of wrangle it and get the owner back, and audiences love that. It's as germane to the form as swearing by the moon and the moon being above you. Mm-hmm. And I think, even though stage managers might be pretty upset with me when I do those sorts of things, I think Shakespeare would be very happy. Mm. It sounds to me like the kind of thing he would intend. Although I will say, it is my belief, even as a shit disturber, that there are rules that can and cannot be broken in the theater. I was doing a production of Three Musketeers, and one of the actors playing one of the cardinal's men came on stage, was, you know, supposed to start this street fight, and they added the word like nerds, and it was just so out of the form. It's so out of the world. And it just kind of irked me. And I went, see, that's too far. Like, it that might fit somewhere else, but for whatever reason, it just didn't fit that. Whereas, you know, coming out on stage with your fly undone and your shirt poking through in a scene that you know, didn't discuss that was going to happen, that might be great. That, because it feels like it could be kind of in the form. But it's really hard to define those things. They feel very outside the realm of written rules. And yet I think that we can all feel them. We can all sort of feel when, oh, that might be one of those theater things you don't cross. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can't describe it any better than that. It sounds so horribly subjective, but there is a thing you can feel. I don't know how else to describe it.
Yeah, no, that makes perfect sense. You've worked with some of the absolute greats of Canadian theatre. Robert Lepage, of course, for Coriolanus, Antolin Tiomolino, artistic director of Stratford, and studied at the Birmingham Conservatory with Stephen Wimmett and Martha Henry, who are legends, absolute legends. Without, again, without making yourself unemployable, Have you ever been asked to do something or on stage that you have just fundamentally disagreed with, but had to? You don't. I would love to hear specific examples with names, but if you don't want to do that, and you don't have to answer this question, but I saw a production at Stratford, in fact, which I thought that some of the people in it weren't on board. And I wasn't sure whether I was blaming the people in it for, I wasn't on board with the production either as it happened. But that always sort of makes me think, how do you get on with just getting on with the job?
I think that rehearsal is for debate and for best idea in the room wins. If the director is willing to, you know, admit that their ideas may not always be the best ideas. And I prefer to work with those kinds of people who have an octagon style ring where you can come in with your best guns and go for it. But I do believe that at a certain point, as you start to invite audiences in, you have to buy in. And, you know, again, without getting myself fired, I watched people in our production of Richard II, even, which is a totally risky and very new, very, very, very new kind of thing for Stratford to do. And I watched, not even divided among age lines or experience line, but I watched some actors take a really long time to buy in, thinking that the production may not fly, and recognizing that, much like how Richard himself as a king only does well when he can feel the power of the people believing in him. And once he comes to terms with his mortality and just being a figure, then it all falls apart. If we, you know, I think audiences may not be able to define what it is, but certainly as another actor watching, I can tell when an actor has bought in or not bought in. And so I make it my practice to buy in at a certain point and just go, you know, I fought for this thing. There's a transition in Richard where I have to do running on the spot. It started out as like a 2-minute thing that two other actors joined me in. And I thought it was comedic in a very tragic moment for the character. I was like, I really don't want to do this. I fought for it a lot. I fought against it a long time. And then they cut the other two actors from it. So it was just me, and they shortened it by 30 seconds. So it's still like, you know, a minute and whatever of me running on the spot. And I still hear folks laughing in the audience. But after having bought in and realizing that I can again flip it, it starts off as a comedic moment as you go, wait, what the hell am I watching? I was just in a Shakespeare play and now I'm watching someone sprint on the spot. But I found out if I could do it technically really well, if I could sort of, you know, provide the illusion of a real sprint, that it would be impressive. And then aside from that ego thing, if I could make it, you know, fatiguing truly for the actor and therefore fatiguing for the character, that it might make the audience a little sick. And then I thought that was a really great way through to the rest of the tragedy, was going, oh my God, he's running on the spot. Oh my God, he's still running on the spot. Oh shit, is he going to be okay? Mm. And then there, it ends in a freeze on stage. So I have to go from full-throated screaming running to frozen. And taking it as seriously as possible made it one of the memorable moments of the show that I keep hearing from people. So you got to put your ego aside sometimes and do the thing you don't want to do. That being said, the names that you mentioned, like, you know, Robert and Anthony, I don't think they've ever asked me to do something that I disagreed with. Robert Lepage is one of those directors who comes in with an incredibly detailed plan for all of the conceits for the scenes. You saw the show. It's like the design had been decided well before. This scene is going to be in a bathhouse. This scene is going to be at a radio station. And so there's not much flexibility there. But anytime an idea didn't work, or, you know, we sort of in the room felt there was a better idea, he was the first to throw out the bad idea and move forward. And I found that really, really admirable, that he could spend several years in workshop for a thing, thinking this is the roadmap we're going to use, and then going, yeah, actually, I don't think that works. Let's try this. Mm-hmm. Martha, being an extraordinary actor and also an extraordinary director, the two don't often correlate, was very good at giving you things that you didn't think you would like or need, but that ended up being these little seeds that would just blossom and totally take over. And so, you know, she'd often say, "I think this character wears a wristwatch." And you'd be like, "Okay, Martha, thanks." And you'd go home and think about it for a couple of days, and you'd put one on in the next rehearsal, and you're like, "Does she want me to look at my, like, she want me to look at it? Does she?" And then over the course of the rehearsal, you'd sort of feel, "Oh, maybe there was something about punctuality or something about rigor, or this person has a sense of urgency or a sense of organization." Like, it would just start to cook in you, and then in the most minute ways weave itself into the performance. It's funny you mentioned Stephen Wimmett, because as an actor animal, I find him very chaotic, but so, so, so much fun. He's often muttering to himself on stage. He's really trying to find the live in the moment present action. And I have a very funny story that I hope is not apocryphal of his. He and Tom McCamus were doing a production of Waiting for Godot. And apparently it was like a da-da, 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 pause, punchline, laugh. Like, there's timing, you know? And Tom McCamus took an extra half beat, and we met on stage to him. They've been pals since they went to university together like 45 years ago. And Wimette said to him, "Too late," just under his breath, "Too late." And it felt like, you know, genius comes with madness. And I do think he was incapable of stopping himself from that kind of interjection, yeah, which is hilarious to give, again, another national treasure, Tom McCamus, a note like that live on stage, just loud enough for only him to hear.
That's wonderful. One of the things that we talk about quite a lot is audience behavior. Are audiences getting worse, do you think?
Coming back from the pandemic for our first full season last year to open the new Tom Paterson Theater, we had 66 performances of Richard III, and every single performance contained at least one cell phone.
No.
Every single performance. And I had to ask myself, did this happen as much as it did, you know, before the pandemic? Is it just that the theater is so acoustically sound that, you know, I can hear a phone vibrate in that theater? It's not just the rings. And then it occurred to me that people working from home or living at home started to live with their ringers on for the first time. Or that people of a certain generation were given smartphones for the first time and never taught how to turn them off. I blame the front of house announcement, which, Ellen, you've heard, is a series of ringing phones that get increasingly more annoying and hilarious. And then a very simple thank you. And people spend time laughing at it, and they spend no time turning off their fucking phones. If I had my druthers, the announcement would be, take a moment to turn your phone off. And if you do not know how, flag an usher or a person under 40 to help you turn your phone off.
Ruprecht, the monkey boy, doing it for you. Thank you.
Yeah. So it felt like coming out of the pandemic, there was, and I remember going to the cinema to see A Quiet Place 2. And I was like, this film is about silence, because the monsters will get you. And people's phones were going off in the movie theater.
It's baffling.
Oh, alien to me. But so that feels like it's getting slightly worse. There is a lot of rustling and opening packages of stuff. I spend a lot of time in Richard II listening, and often not the focus. And if somebody is in the second row, right, you know, 5 feet away from me, opening a packet of peanuts or something, I tend to look over at them.
Do you? Do you give them a glare?
And just try to catch their eye to be like, I can hear you. Just, you know, I can hear you. And so can everyone else, without being disruptive to the story, or, you know, and then I dive right back in. But especially in that Tom Paterson Theater, it is so acoustically sound. There are 600 and whatever seats, but everyone is within an arm's reach from you. So people have to know, I can hear you.
There was a baby in when I went to see La Belle Sœur this time round. There was a baby in the audience.
who was crying, which completely baffled me and how on earth they managed to get it in. The other amusing thing, which was audience behavior, was at the end of King Lear. So everybody's dead. And there was a phone went off during King Lear, but thankfully during quite a loud bit, and they managed to sort of fumble and
put off. Storm.
Not quite the storm bit. That would have been really annoying because I was really enjoying the storm bit. But at the end, we're all applauding King Lear. Everything, you know, everyone's dead. It's the end. Blah, blah, blah. And there's somebody a few rows away from me going, more. Encore. And like, everybody's dead. You can't, I don't know what you're expecting them to do. Yeah, it's like, well, we need the dance number at the end.
Cue the burger mask.
Yeah. But the baby,
Yeah, I think we had a baby in our audience for Richard the Second last time that we did it.
And you can't bring a baby to that sort of thing.
There's simulated sex on stage and violence and guns and all kinds of crazy stuff. And it just felt so like, I don't even know how that passed front of house. And at one point during an early scene, I thought to myself, just bring the kid back here and we'll have somebody watch him and you can, you know, I do think the theaters should start considering childcare because, you know, I have loads of friends who are like, yeah, I would love to come, but can't get a moment away from my 2-year-old. I do have one very funny story that has been passed down in the annals of Stratford history. I think it's from Mother Courage at the old Tom Patterson, and Shauna McKenna's on stage and a cell phone goes off. And so she just sort of pauses and then the cell phone stops and she continues to speak, but the person has picked up the phone. And they've gone, while the speech is happening, they've gone, no, I'm sorry, I'm in a show. Yeah, it's Shauna McKenna.
Oh my God.
She's actually quite good. God. And Shauna tells the story of being able to hear that, because of course you can hear that.
That is absolutely horrific.
I guess that's slightly better than, no. I've seen her do better, you know.
Yeah, she's all right, but you know. Yeah. Can we end on the bomb threat? It's not the most cheery story to end on, but it was totally a sort of legendary incident. And you were in the show that got evacuated, I think.
Yes, that was wild. So it was 2018. We were doing The Tempest, Martha Henry's Tempest, directed by Anthony,
which was brilliant.
Thank you. I played Adrian, who's one of the courtiers with beautiful long hair. God, I wanted to keep that wig. And so we're all backstage at the Half. It's the grand opening night, which typically occurs on a Monday at about 7:30 to give time for press and all this stuff. It's a huge to-do. And we've gotten into costume and wigs, and Anthony comes over the paging system to say, I'm so sorry, ladies and gentlemen, we have to evacuate the building immediately. There's been a bomb threat called on the building. And we were like, what? It felt like the world's worst joke. But apparently someone had phoned in saying there's a bomb in the building. I'm going to blow it up. And what proceeded to happen was, you know, please exit the building as calmly as possible. And people were screaming and running and... Really? Friends of mine just wailing. It was so awful. But I kind of get, I don't know, my guard dog gets up in these kinds of scenarios. And I took my time. I took off my costume. I put my opening night suit on. I said to myself, you want to blow me up? You blow me up. Okay? You're taking away this big night from me. Screw you, whoever you are. And I took my time to calmly get out of the building, get all my stuff. And then apparently they had dogs sweep the building. And the very next day, I can't remember what show it was, The Music Man maybe, did a performance. Mm. And so it was, we were really only paused for a little while. There was a press conference at the Bruce Hotel and they like quartered us off. And we didn't actually get to open that show for another 2 weeks.
Wow. Mm.
Which just took the Mickey out of everything. There was like all of this energy moving towards this big, but of course, Ellen, as you alluded to earlier, there's a stunning photo of Martha Henry carrying her staff and her book, I think, and walking out of the theater as Prospero, just saying, yeah, no, they can't take it from us. And there was a brief moment where we thought maybe we would do it in the band shell that's right out in Lower Queens Park. There's a little band shell there that they sometimes do nightly music. And we sort of toyed with, well, what if we just have everyone out here and we do the show anyway? But it was a very tech heavy show. I don't know how well it would have done if it was just us in our open press. but that was one of the craziest experiences I've ever had in the theater. And as far as I know, we didn't ever find out who did it.
Oh, really? Oh, I was going to ask that. So no idea the motivation or anything, or
ever any follow up. My guess, the thing that sticks in my gut about it, is some shitty teenager didn't want to go to opening night with their rich parents, and so they called in a bomb threat as a horrid joke to get it.
Didn't realize the consequences of actually doing that
at all. But yeah, that was a wild, wild, wild experience. I can end on a more chipper one that I think is really fun. So there's a production of at Shaw of You Never Can Tell. And this story's been passed on to me. And the last line of that play is, well, you never can tell, eh? I guess you really never can tell. And the actor getting ready to say the final line one night goes, you can't, well, you shouldn't, I guess you, fuck. And then the curtain fell. So that's probably my favorite goof of all time.
And the actor's going to be thinking about that for the rest of their lives, every single day.
I just think it's the magic of live theater. Yeah, I had a very similar, another one in Romeo and Juliet that I did. The prince said, for never was a story of more woe than this of Roliet and her Julio.
Oh, no.
Hey.
And thereafter, the director made it a sound cue. Actually recorded the line so that he wouldn't get a chance to cock it up again.
Right, we're about to lose you. Thank you so much. That was really nice of you to do that. That was really great.
Oh, thanks for having me, you guys. And a pleasure to meet you, Alistair.
Lovely to meet you, yeah. Thank you. Yeah. That was lovely. That was just great. It was really super to catch up with Emilio. That tale of the bomb alert, that was quite something.
Yeah, that was, I mean, that
not something you hear of too often.
No, that must have been quite stressful. I watched that sort of unfolding via Instagram, because I'm following a lot of the actors and the theatre itself on Instagram. And this sort of thing came up saying that they'd been evacuated, and then you were sort of following along trying to see what happened. But he was there defiantly putting on his suit.
Well, there was that theatre in Chechnya as well, where there was that horrible, horrible situation many years ago.
Oh, gosh, yes, I remember that.
Which was just terrifying, with the gas. And then, of course, going back to Christopher Nolan, ding, dong, ding, Christopher Nolan alert, there's Inception, which I think probably was inspired partly, you know, the start of that was partly inspired by that situation as well. So, quite something.
Anyway. Thanks. Thanks, Amelia.
Yeah, on that happy note.
That's us for this week. If you would like to get in touch, you can email us on downthebackoftheseats@gmail.com.
Or you can find us on the media social, on all your main medias, including Threads, which I've never seen. But
I haven't looked at it for ages. So maybe not Threads. Instagram or Facebook is probably the safest places to be. We are down the back of the seats in those places. All right. See you next week.
Thanks for listening. See you again. Cheers. Thank you.